Your Best Story, tonight's assignment abroad for four veteran broadcasters. On January 1st of this year, the CBC News Service was 15 years old. Part of that service is the reporting of CBC correspondents in London, Paris, Washington, and the United Nations. Recently, we asked all four men to choose the most interesting assignment they have covered in their years abroad. And tonight, you'll hear the choices of Matthew Halton, Peter Sturzberg, Douglas Lachance, and James M. Menifee. Senior in years of service is Matthew Halton in London, whose assignments began in the most exciting days of the war. Now here is his account of May the 8th, 1945.
I think it was the day when I reported the end of the world. That is, something that looked like the end of the world. Berlin on VE Day. A day earlier, General Eisenhower had taken the unconditional surrender of the German armies at his headquarters in France. The next day, Air Marshal Tedder, who was Eisenhower's British deputy, flew into Berlin to join the Russian commander, Marshal Zhukov, in a similar ceremony. He could take with him only 10 of the hundreds of war correspondents, and I had the luck to be one of them. It was a lovely day, and the heart of the world seemed to be soaring with joy. We flew over the skeleton of Cologne Cathedral and over the Rhine. At the Elbe, Russian fighters met us and escorted us into Berlin. And we flew into a vast cloud of smoke and dust. The great city of 5 million people was still smoking and burning. And when we came down through this cloud and saw what we saw, we were all speechless. 4 out of 5 buildings in Berlin had been destroyed. That is, completely leveled or completely gutted. This did look like the end of the world. On Tempelhof Airfield, in that appalling scene of ruin, Marshal Tedder took the salute in a march past of 10,000 Russian guards. Then we were driven to Zhukov's headquarters, through the rubble and ashes of Berlin. I didn't recognize famous streets I had known well. In that long, appalling drive, we saw only 9 or 10 Berliners, old men and women, scarecrows, crawling out frightened to see the British and American flags. Just before midnight, we saw the German, Field Marshal Keitel. He was hanged later. We saw him slowly strip off his glove and sign the surrender. Then the Russians gave us a banquet that lasted all night. In the morning, we went out again into the fearful scene. The Russians took us to see the smoking ruins of Hitler's famous marble chancellery, but they didn't show us the bunker where he died. As we left, my car was the last in the procession. And at one point, in the clouds of dust, my driver lost the others. We were lost for a few minutes in that utter ruin and silence, in the end of the world. I was afraid. But soon we were in the airplane again, flying out of the ruin into the bright smile of France and the sunshine of victory and peace. This is Matthew Halton speaking from London.
For the last 5 years, Peter Sturzberg has covered the United Nations for the CBC, but for his story tonight, he goes back to the days when he was one of our war correspondents.
It was only the other day that I realized how I came to be the first to broadcast the song of the last war, Lily Marlene. I was reading Dennis Johnston's memoirs, 9 Rivers from Jordan, in which he tells how he used to listen to Lily Marlene while waiting for the Battle of Alamein. The British Tommies called it their bedtime song. And sitting on the sand in the sparkling desert night with the wireless tuned in to Radio Beograd, Dennis Johnston, who was a BBC correspondent, marveled at the way a German girl was singing the opposing armies to sleep. He prepared a broadcast about this, but was told, "What? Give publicity to Lily Marlene? No, you don't." And so it happened that months later, I came along and made a recording of the song, which somehow got past the censor and was transmitted to Canada via London. I, too, was struck by the way our Canadian soldiers took to Lily Marlene. But what impressed me more was the fact that when we landed in Sicily, the peasants were singing it in the fields. And so, during the lull between the Sicilian and Italian campaigns, I hired a little local orchestra, which included an operatic tenor, to record Lily Marlene. It's a sad song, really, a sentimental song about a soldier's promise to meet his girl again beside a lamppost in the rain, a promise which is never kept, and even if you didn't understand it, as most of the Canadians didn't, there was its haunting tune. Sometime later, when we entered Berlin, I was to meet the composer Norbert Schulze and to learn the full story of Lily Marlene. It was a flop, he said, when it first came out. But the war came along and the gramophone company tried to cash in by changing the name of the record from Lily Marlene to the Song of the Young God. But that didn't work, at least not immediately. The Germans were flushed with victory, and Wir fahren gegen England was their song. But the war went on, and the Wehrmacht took Radio Beograd and turned it into a forces station for the Africa Corps. Even the Nazis were growing tired when the soldier who was in charge of the new station looked through a pile of old records and saw the Song of the Young God and thought that it would be a good one to put on at 10 at Lights Out. He played it three nights running and then decided that it wasn't much good. But by then it was made. The German soldiers insisted that it be put on every night. A camp was named Lily Marlene by the Africa Corps, and a statue was put up to her on the road to Minsk in Russia. Lana Anderson, the girl who sang the song, was skyrocketed to fame. But poor Norbert Schulze only collected a few thousand marks in royalties because not many records could be made in war-short Germany. Not only were the Germans singing it, but the Allies as well. And in the end, the Germans did not sing it anymore, and only the Allies did. I have one of the original recordings of Lily Marlene. It was difficult to come by. And when I play it now, it reminds me of dark nights in Sicily, and the darker silhouettes of the olive trees, of the rain and mud in Italy, and the sound of the guns and comrades of old.
Peter Sturzberg, now at the United Nations. Since 1952, our Paris correspondent, has been Douglas Lachance, formerly of Ottawa. His story is of recent events in France.
Like the time that making a routine political recording of a communist demonstration, I stood with open microphone in the Place de la République, and nearby police stopped a small black sedan from which they jerked a little fat man carrying a briefcase, whose sputters went down on my tape. That was Jacques Duclos, Secretary General of the French Communist Party. His arrest was first an international sensation, and then a subject of comedy, for the police searching his car found in the back three pigeons and in the front a radio. The police classified the first as carrier pigeons, obviously standard equipment for any spy, and the radio as a transmitter. Duclos was later able to prove that the pigeons had been both dead and standard birds of the eating variety given him by a friend. As for the radio, it turned out to be an ordinary car set which didn't even get police calls. Probably that occasion was memorable only for the excitement at the time and the humor of the official mismanagement afterwards. What other stories do I remember? Well, there was the Army Day parade in May 54, the week after the fall of Dien Bien Phu, a parade the Lanyol cabinet did not dare to attend. President Coty alone reviewing the ranks of troops on the Champs-Élysées, while hundreds of thousands of shamed people stood in absolute silence to watch. And the next day, de Gaulle walking up the Champs-Élysées alone, while frightened police and troops kept watch and held back crowds lest he summon them to a coup d'etat. The aging general in the old brown uniform, but gray at the temples now, moving stiffly as always across the Place de l'Étoile, and standing at attention in front of the unknown soldier's grave and the eternal flame. And from everywhere, from all the thousands behind the police lines, surged up the Marseillaise chanted softly. Even the soldiers around the Ark singing it too. Coming after a great national humiliation, the event had the relieving effect of tears after tragedy. There are other memories. Pierre Mendes France coming to power soon after, milk drinking, happily buoyant, so unused to power he refused an official car at first, and went everywhere in his battered old Citroën, while we of the press roared after. And when Mendes' cabinet fell, 4 a.m. last February 5th, the retiring premier trying to speak, merely to pass on advice about the budget, and the hundreds of mediocrities filled with hatred for the one Frenchman since the war who had tried to govern, screaming their venom so not one single word of his speech could be heard, and he had to make it to the official stenographer under the rain of cries, Jew, assassin, traitor. I've never considered these anecdotes together before, but I think now, looking at them, that they contain a common point. The French refuse to conform to the norm. All their activities have an element of comedy and tragedy. Whoever has the privilege of covering this country will find just watching its people react to history memorable in itself. This is Douglas LaChant speaking from Paris.
Finally, James M. Menifee reports regularly from Washington, but his choice tonight recalls the days when he was correspondent for the New York Herald Tribune and sent only occasional stories to his native Canada.
Just before Christmas 1941, I was sitting with a friend in a little hotel room in Washington, waiting for Wendell Willkie, the leader of the Republican Party, to come back from the White House. President Roosevelt had sent for him secretly. It was a grim time for the democracies. The American Pacific Fleet was sitting at the bottom on Pearl Harbor. The Japs were on the march. Great pressure was building up in the United States to concentrate on the Pacific and let Europe ride. It would have been the popular but fatal decision, and we wondered if Willkie were getting that pitch. He stumbled into the room. "I just can't tell you, fellows," he said. "He swore me to secrecy." We waited. Wilkie could never keep a secret long. He took a deep breath. Then he whispered, "Churchill's coming." I had a flash of conviction. At that moment, I felt the tide was turning. I still believe that this was the furthest ebb. To be sure, many disasters were ahead. Singapore and Manila would fall. The battleships Repulse and Prince of Wales would be sunk. But Alamein was only 6 months ahead, and this made Alamein possible. At this Christmas, the Grand Alliance would be founded, the European struggle given priority, and Congress and the people reconciled to it. FDR and Churchill had a rendezvous with destiny. The two leaders gave a press conference, jointly, in the little oval room in the White House where the president worked. FDR sat at his cluttered desk. He had a cigarette in a long holder. Churchill sat beside him, pink and bland, with his inevitable cigar. Both were prima donnas, and I hoped that they were not getting in each other's hair. But obviously, the two were getting along famously. As we crowded in, FDR leaned over to Churchill and said softly, nodding toward us, "They're an awful bunch of wolves, you know, and I'm going to throw you to them." Churchill chuckled. He answered the first question sitting down. Someone at the back shouted, "Can't hear you." And someone else said, "Or see you." Then the amazing man stood up. He climbed laboriously onto his chair, beamed at the reporters, waved his cigar, and gave the V sign. He said simply, "Here I am." That took care of the press. They forgot the tough questions they'd come to ask. Next day, he brought Congress into camp. They shouted with laughter when he commented to a joint session of the House and Senate, "If my father had been American and my mother British, instead of the other way around, I might have got here on my own." The nation bought him when he helped light the White House Christmas tree. Churchill was always a good assignment. That was the best of them. This is James M. Menifee in Washington.
This has been Assignment Abroad, a choice of stories by CBC foreign correspondents. Tonight's special program marked the 15 years of the CBC News Service, which includes regular reporting from London, Paris, Washington, and the United Nations. This is the Dominion Network of the CBC.